Hi, you're listening to the Wayfinding Podcast. We are your hosts, Mark Draper and Joe Thomas. This podcast is brought to you by Life Together House. This is a podcast for those who think history matters. Here, we will listen to the lives of faithful Christians who have come before us as they help us find our way today as followers of Jesus Christ. We will walk together through the events, places, relationships that shape their lives, telling their story, learning from their witness, navigating our path in today's world. This is Season 2, Wayfinding on the Road to Revival.
What is revival? It's restoration. What is revival? It's waking up from sleep.
God sent His Son, Jesus Christ, to the cross to die for you.
Oh, brother, it's wonderful to be alive if you let Jesus come into your heart.
And that's a revival. You want to be part of it? Don't you?
Revival. Renewing the heart. Revitalizing the church.
So, Mark, welcome to your first Wayfinding podcast, where we look for direction and signs from the history of the church and its people. It's great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
Today, we're going to be looking at the first 1,000 years or so in church history. We're going to be working in conjunction with the Christian History Magazine. And we're going to be looking at revivalism, reform, you know, sort of this idea of restoration that happens in this very unique time period of the early church and the medieval church. I really want to start with a question. It's a question that deals with our conception of revival. Probably for most of our listeners, the conception of revival has something to do with people like Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, maybe Amy Semple McPherson, Billy Graham, for sure. So I'm wondering, for our audience, is there a trigger warning that we should give as we're talking about this time period?
I think we need an evangelical trigger warning, at least in two spots here. Yeah, even when I think of the word revival, my head automatically goes to tents and horses and sawdust trails and anxious benches. Mm. We are recording this in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in the Tri-County area. There still are a number of campgrounds, and people every summer go to camp meeting for revivals. Mm. So there's sort of the trappings that they sort of expect to see. So if we're talking about a revival, they're like, well, that doesn't look like my camp meeting.
So no anxious bench, but perhaps there were people on their knees going up steps.
We do know that's true, right? So it is a different way of God doing revival, right? And it seems a bit that God does revival differently based on where and when. The other sort of trigger warning, too, I think, is some evangelicals don't really know what to do with the Middle Ages, right? Mm. It's like Christianity somehow got restarted after Luther. But I think it's fair to say that in reading this issue, what you quickly learn is these are people who are devoted to Jesus. They love Jesus. They are brothers and sisters in the faith. They love the Lord. It might look different sometimes even theologically, but commitment-wise, nothing's different. And I think there's two important things to remember. We have to broaden our category of what this looks like to really appreciate what God is doing in this time period.
Should we think about revivalism really as being part of just the DNA of our faith, the DNA of Christianity, going all the way back to the time of Jesus? You know, Jesus is calling the disciples out from their lives. Yeah. He is preaching to the masses, upwards to thousands of people at time. We see transformation happening in people. You know, mere fishermen are becoming fishers of men.
Yeah.
It's an amazing moment, and you have a religious establishment which is corrupt. It has warped things, even doctrinally has warped things. So it seems like this is, in a way, kind of sets a template for the future of the church.
The issue does such a great job at that, at demonstrating that really Jesus is sort of the prototype of the revivalist. Now it's a little different, right? He's ushering in the new covenant, and things are happening in God's plan, redemption history. But it operates very much like a revival. A lot of probably nominal Jewish believers, or maybe not even believers, are drawn to God in new ways, in new rich ways, through the ministry of Jesus, through the disciples, and that kind of work. And so, yeah, you could almost look at the way the new covenant comes in. It is really a revival and a sort of fulfillment of the old covenant.
Yeah, that's good. We're going to be working through this first issue of Christian History Magazine. And I really like the way they grappled with how do you define a revival, particularly, you know, again, with so many of us who have this conception in our mind what a revival is, to go back in time into the medieval and early church and to think, well, what does it look like there? What are ways in which to define it? And one of the ways that they put forward is this conception, just they use the word popular, and it's this idea that a revival is more than just a personal revival. It begins as personal revival, but it expands quickly into crowds and masses and has transformative impact on the world around it.
Yeah, I hearken back to the time we were in Boston Common doing some recording on George Whitefield and found that 20,000 people attended revivals in Boston Common to hear George Whitefield preach, and only 10,000 people at the time lived in Boston. I mean, that's popular. Or the same with George Whitefield in Philadelphia and Benjamin Franklin telling in his autobiography how far he could walk away and how big the crowd was, and he could still hear George Whitefield. It's more than just a handful of people. Those are revivals, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about these larger revivals. The category does fit in the way we've understood church history. These generally are larger movements that take on an energy. And even going back to Jesus, right? That's a popular movement.
Right. You think about his Sermon on the Mount. There are thousands of people. Some people estimate maybe 20,000 people. That's a mass movement. That's a revival in contrast to a person having a personal revival. You know, we were talking about this before we came on air, and, you know, I have friends who are from Britain, a couple of men who've come to faith, but they've come to faith personally, not out of a larger revival context. Revivalism is something unique, and you can define it, you can see it, you know what it is.
Yeah.
And this popular part, that it's a mass movement of people into the faith, we'll talk a little later, it also spins off stuff,
yeah,
apocalyptic thinking, it spins off usually some heretical stuff on the fringes.
Yes.
But at the heart of it, it is God
calling his people back to him. This is the story of how God brought his people back to him. I tend to look at the story of the people of God in that lens, in that longer story. And I think this is a trend, right? There's a trend in the story of the people of God of times when they're faithful and they're walking with God. There's times when they're repenting and they're wearing sackcloth and ashes and they're coming back to God. And then there's times when they walk away from God. And sometimes they happen at the same time. We shouldn't be surprised, but this is just how God has chosen to create his church and work with his people, that at times, because of his long suffering, he's going to allow them to walk off. But then he's not leaving them there. I will bring you back. I will bring you back. And sometimes the way he brings you back, you'd rather not have gone off on the first place.
Right.
What this story tells me is this is the faithfulness of God, not God's people.
And you know, you really see that in the medieval time period.
Yeah.
Whether it's St. Francis and the beginning of the Franciscan movement, and it's a popular movement. He himself gives himself over. He hears about the life of Jesus and that the disciples, they've given everything up. They've left families. They've left their livelihoods, their money, total commitment to Christ. That really just like touches something within him. And the rich young ruler, we think about when Jesus says to him, you know, if you want to be perfect, go and sell everything you have. And we see with Francis that this resonates with the people of his time.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, perhaps, because medieval Christianity had sort of been broken into different hierarchical,
yep,
spheres, if you were the monastic, the church. He did something completely different, where he's just walking through the villages preaching and not asking for anything in return, sort of a counterintuitive way of critiquing, if you will.
Yeah.
I'm not asking anything while the church continues to ask for more. And that whole monetization of the faith that sadly develops in quite a large part of the medieval church.
The rule and life of these brothers is this, namely, to live in obedience and chastity and without property, and to follow the doctrine and footsteps of our Lord Jesus Christ, who says, "If thou wilt be perfect, go sell what thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me. And if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. In like manner, If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And everyone that hath left father or mother, brothers or sisters or wife or children or lands for my sake shall receive 100-fold and shall possess life everlasting. St. Francis, from First Rule of the Friars Minor.
But you see this popular aspect with Francis. Jan Hus has followers. You see it in Wycliffe with the Lollards. All of these different movements, the Waldensians, all of these, which this first issue covers quite well, you know, really shows you how there is this popular aspect.
Which says to me there are people that God's spirit is working when he embraces these movements, and there are people who are yearning for this, right? This is not just St. Francis felt this way. Other people are like, yes, I feel this way. Yes, I want this. Yes, I want that deeper relationship with God. What do I need to do? And I like the way you put that, how it's almost by what he didn't say or didn't do that made him appealing. I've often heard jazz musicians say, sometimes it's the note you don't hit that comes across the best. Imagine if you're a peasant and you're being taxed by the king and the church, and all of a sudden, this is just relationship with God and I don't have to pay for it.
Yes. There's some great quotes from Jan Hus and others that are talking about bringing the message back to the centrality of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And that Jesus is the head of the church. Bernardino of Siena is talking about how if you have to choose between the mass and preaching, you choose preaching, which I about fell off my chair. I'd actually not heard that quote before. That gets to one of the things we want to talk about later, which is when do you get in trouble with the medieval church? It's when you challenge their authority.
But tell me, what would become of this world, I mean of the Christian faith, if there were no preaching? Within a very little, our faith would have perished, for we would believe nothing of that which we now believe. And because of this, Holy Church has ordered that every Sunday there shall be preaching. And the Church has ordered you go to hear Mass. And if of these two duties you can perform but one, you should rather lose Mass and hear the preaching. You do not so endanger your soul by not hearing Mass as by not listening to the preaching. Bernardino of Siena.
That transformation of heart that you were talking about, and it seems to always begin with a person or a small group of people, it resonates with a larger audience. Talk a little bit about that, that transformational aspect. Yeah. That's our second sort of parameter that the Christian History Magazine has put on revivalism as we think about it. Popular, transformative.
It's this idea where I think that once people have their sort of spiritual life in check and now God is back to the center, now how shall I live? How am I different in that way? How does this make me a different person in my day-to-day life? And you and I, we've studied revivals from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So I think when we read this, we were kind of looking for commonalities, right, in the period we studied and said, oh, yes, you do see this, right? Mm-hmm. You do see transformation in how people live. And I'll go back to Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. He actually talks about how everyone seems different in Philadelphia after Whitfield came through, that the taverns are closed and people are singing psalms. Like he was astounded by this.
I just came from Philly, and that's an astounding statement.
Yeah, it doesn't happen as very much there today. Yeah, depends where you're at. So it does change the way people are. And I think it's the James principle. I think once you start to get that sense of my priorities are right, I'm back in line with God, I don't want to just be a hearer of the word. I want to be a doer of the word. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the idea of Augustine that we are restless until we find our satisfaction in you. And I think that's when you get the transformation.
The soul is the greening life force of the flesh, for the body grows and prospers through her, just as the earth becomes fruitful when it is moistened. The soul humidifies the body, so it does not dry out, just like the rain which soaks into the earth. The word is living, being, spirit, all verdant greening, all creativity. This word manifests itself in every creature. You are rewarded, not according to time or work, but according to the measure of your love. For ye are all trees of love, and without love ye cannot live, for ye have been made by me for love. Hildegard. Love transforms you into what you love. To show the love we have to him, we ought to serve and love every rational creature. Lose yourself wholly. The more you lose, the more you will find. Catherine of Siena.
I mean, that's such a great example, you know, Augusta's confessions. I mean, on one hand, you could see that as sort of a personal conversion, but it's in a larger context of, you know, he reads about Antony in the desert, and it drives him crazy that this less than educated monk out in the desert has actual control over his lust, mm-hmm. which, of course, is Augustine's great yes. problem. And it drives him deeper. Why is this guy able to control himself and I can't? And it takes him back to Paul. But it leads to larger transformation.
The fruits of the earth are not brought to perfection immediately, but by time, rain, and care. Similarly, the fruits of men ripen through aesthetic practice, study, time, perseverance, self-control, and patience. Regard as free not those whose status makes them outwardly free, but those who are free in their character and conduct. For we should not call men truly free when they are wicked and dissolute, since they are slaves to worldly passions. Freedom and happiness of soul consist in genuine purity and detachment from transitory things. St. Antony.
That's what's key, I think, in these revivals. There's something not quite right in the preaching. Is there hypocrisy in the church? Is there a desire for more money? There's something that's just not quite right. And even doctrine, right? If something's been tweaked in a way that's not quite right. Until it's articulated, everybody's sort of in this state of, we know something's not quite right, but we're not quite sure what it is. All of a sudden, it comes to realization, and this really is like the third point of these parameters that the magazine has put together. This idea of reform is part of the process that we should think about when we're thinking about revivalism in this time period. There's a need for reform, and that need and that call lead to transformation.
Now we're going to actually bring these changed people into the culture and into the society, and they are going to address various issues. You have people who know something's not right, and maybe someone like a Francis comes along, and we've both been in situations like this where we've had conversations with people and we wax eloquent with a certain thought. And they're like, you know, I've been thinking that.
Right.
I just didn't have the language for it. And it's possible that in some of these places, one of the reasons the popular happens is because the people God raises up, is the Spirit is giving them language for the people that they knew it was there. They just didn't have the language yet, right? And then all of a sudden, we have the language.
That's really good. You know, in our earlier podcast that we did, Wayfinding with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer has this great quote where he talks about this new language, that there's always this need for new language because the world changes, culture changes, history moves on. And so while God is always at work, it's always God initiating, it's God that's moving, it's his Spirit that is convicting. It always looks a little different because it's in a different historical context.
Yes. I mean, even the language of Whitfield, right? He's using political language oftentimes to describe the same situation we're having in our faith. That's going to have a trickle-down effect in many ways. So I think that's something I see in this, that you're right. People have a yearning that something's not quite right, and they just don't know what to do about it, and they don't know how to articulate it. And then all of a sudden, you get someone who comes along who's like, yes, that's it. And then now we have a movement.
That transformation also leads to a life of devotion. It's not just a one and done, this was great for today, but I'm still my same person tomorrow. It's now a new desire to follow God, to follow him daily, and to have a life of devotion that shows that.
Whether it's the church or individuals, when we stray off our relationship from God, it's generally because we're not doing the devotional things we should be doing to stay with God. And that works in relationships with friends, with your spouse or whatever. There are certain practices, right?
That disciplines.
And I think for the Christian, this is so important too, because we do live in this sort of weird space between citizens of the city of God living in the city of man. And the city of man, way before the internet, was still very powerful in promoting its ideas. So we constantly need to be in those devotional spaces. Otherwise, the city of man will rearrange our categories for us. They will give us a different reality. So we always have to be called back to the reality of this is the world after the risen Jesus, because that's not how the city of man operates. They have different categories. Part of the devotion is that if I'm going to stay that way, I have to be devoted and have my mind, my heart, and my soul shaped in a way that realizes I might be living here in this quote-unquote reality, but the real reality is Jesus sitting at the right hand of the Father holding all things together.
You really see that this issue in Christian History Magazine talks about Julian of Norwich, talk about divine love, talks about Marjorie of Kemp and her devotion. And so you see the revival leads to a devoted life. Bernard of Clairvaux is another one. Yeah. And with it, in the medieval time period, it may look a little different, perhaps awkward, perhaps funny, I don't know.
Well, there could be self-flagellating. That's not exactly something we're promoting.
Right. And that brings up a great point, right? Is that in the midst of these revivals in different contexts, there are still cultural holds on us.
Yes.
And we do things that in retrospect, historically speaking,
yeah,
we realize, okay, that was not a good thing. I'm thinking here of Bernard of Clairvaux, who writes the most beautiful words about God's love. Luther himself refers to Clairvaux as second to Augustine.
That's pretty high praise for Luther.
Second to Augustine in terms of his admiration for his writings because of the power and the impact they had. And yet, what do we see? We see Bernard is out there preaching to raise up people, to go on the Crusades, to massacre people in the Holy Land.
In the name of God.
In the name of God. And not only that, but promising that, you know what, if you die in battle, you're going straight to heaven. What a corruption of the gospel. And yet it's in the midst of this person who's writing these wonderful writings of God's love.
Yeah. I've started giving what I call my first class trigger warning, because I think, one, a lot of people come in, they don't know a lot about church history, but they might come in with the expectation, oh, it's the story of the church, this should be a good story. And I have to remind them that just like us, the people came before us, we're citizens of the city of God, living in the city of man. And sometimes the values of the city of man creep in. And sometimes the values of the city of man get baptized in with the city of God. And this can happen. I think that's an important thing to remember is that, yes, people can be growing and having a greater intimacy with God, yet at the same time, still have these cultural blind spots, whether it's crusades or slavery or you name it. That's sort of the way it is living in this already not yet. It's not right. It's not good. We still need to call it out and we still need to be concerned about it. But this is the reality we're faced with in the life of believers.
Yeah, it's almost as if in the individual you have process of sanctification. It's almost as if in the corporate church, historically speaking, we're always in a process of sanctification as well. We're learning revivalism has been wonderful, but how do we move these extraneous bad parts off the stage of the church?
Once Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire in the fourth century, the church is in a very different position. Mm-hmm. They're now inside. They're not outside any longer. Mm-hmm. And they're inside politically. They're inside socially and culturally. It's much easier to be prophetic from the margins and on the outside. You can look at, say, the New Testament church and the persecuted church. They've had a different set of issues. They're being thrown to lions. But historically, there seems to be a tendency to compromise, or when you kind of sort of see to yourself, you've got a seat at the table, you're part of the group. Well, I have to defend the Crusades. I have to defend this. That's a tension there.
Yeah, you really lose your prophetic voice. Whenever you are taken in by the state, we tend to think in terms of, well, we're going to influence the state. And in some ways we do. And, and there are good things that come out of that. We have the peace of God and truce of God. These are medieval ideas that took root, that lowered the violence of the knights in the medieval time. So there are laws that are developed. Religious toleration eventually comes into effect. So it's not all bad. I mean, Christendom produces some good stuff, but it also can turn back around and bite you. I just finished a class where we were talking about Constantine, the first Christian emperor. And when I teach that, I like to go through, and here's a new precedent that was set between the church and the state. And here was another new precedent that was set. You know, the army of the state was sent to put down the Donatists, a schism. That's a new precedent. And I like to go through precedent, 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 because it makes the point that something brand new has been born here, not all of it good. You know, I think a big question that we have when we start thinking about this time period is, where do revivals come from? What are they birthed out of? We've been talking a lot about individuals and the personal devotional side of that, right? There's been something missing and a new birth has happened, and that leads to this popular explosion that happens. But it's also true in the medieval time period that there were specific spaces in which revival could emerge.
And one of the first ones, I think you've already touched on it, is monasticism with St. Anthony, right? And what was driving him to go to the wilderness. The wilderness motif always seems to follow church, right? Jesus went to the wilderness, John the Baptist, and, you know, they go do battle with the devil. And there's this idea that, like, I'm going to give Satan home field advantage. I'm going to his playground. I'm going to be the visiting team. I'm going to the wilderness to let you throw everything you can at me. There you have a personal person, but again, it starts to spread, right? People see this and they start to go out to meet with these solitary desert fathers. And they're basically doing it for what we just said. They saw the marriage of the church and state. They're concerned about where's true piety going to be in this relationship. So they kind of go away, almost like the Essenes in the first century. I'm going to go out to the wilderness and I'm going to do battle with Satan and become a holy person. That kind of births a bit of a movement. Other people say, yes, I'm going to do the same thing. Or they'll go out and I want to talk to you. So there's something somewhat appealing about this holy person that people want to be around. I think you mentioned it to me that even Constantine wrote to St. Anthony.
Yes. Yes, he wrote letters to St. Anthony. And Anthony replied to basically pursue justice and be good to the poor. That was his advice back to him, which I think is actually not bad. If you're going to boil it down to two things for an emperor, in this case, a very strong, all-powerful emperor, those are a couple of really good things to emphasize. I think it's fascinating as you get into the medieval time period of our church history, that monasticism that comes, that's birthed out of St. Anthony's vocational work in the desert, and as it grows and develops under St. Benedict and others in the medieval time period, you really see that become the part of the church that reform comes out of. The leadership of the church is coming out of the monasteries. So if the monasteries are not working well, if there's corruption in the monasteries, then that means your leadership coming in to bishops, the papacy, is probably going to have the same problems. So in the medieval time period, it was common then for people to call back to Jesus, to call back to Benedict's rule. We have to get back to a place of greater holiness, or we're never going to be able to challenge this corruption.
How divine office shall be said in the daytime. As the prophet says, seven times in the day do I praise thee. This sacred number seven will thus be fulfilled by us if, as lauds, at the first, third, sixth, ninth hours, at vesper time, and at compotorium, we perform the service of our duties. For it is of these hours of the day that he said, seven times in the day do I praise thee. For concerning the night hours, the same prophet says, at midnight I arose to confess unto thee. Therefore, at these times, let us give thanks to our Creator concerning the judgments of his righteousness, that is, at matins, etc. And at night, we will rise and confess to him. Of reverence and prayer. When we make application to men in high positions, we do not presume to do so without reverence and humility. How much more, then, are we bound to entreat God, the Lord of all, with all humility and devout purity of heart, and we must recognize that we are heard not so much for our speaking, but for our purity of heart and tears of contrition. Therefore, our prayer must be brief and pure, unless it chance be prolonged with the inspiration of God's grace. When we assemble together, let the prayer be quite brief, and let us all rise together when the prior gives the signal. Benedict's Rule.
It's a scary situation when the heartbeat of revival gets corrupted. So you will see revival movements within monastic movements.
Right.
So it's like third degree revival, and then right. that has to get put on place. But what's interesting in the Middle Ages is people sort of saw the monasteries as the place to get right with God. I'll never forget this. We were in Erfurt, Germany, and we actually got to tour Luther's monastery. They actually told us you could stay there. There's a B&B there. But the B&B is actually the little holding cells that they had for the drunken college students who, after a bender, would come and want to give their life to Jesus.
So
they'd come to the monastery.
Love it.
They'd put them in these little rooms, and they'd say, okay, dry you out. And if you're here in the morning, we'll talk. I said 9 times out of 10, once the liquid courage wore off, they were gone. And Luther, he stayed for a month, so they figured he must be real. So that's interesting, right, that in this period, people look to the monastery. If I'm going to get my life right with God, that's where I have to go do it.
The place which Jesus takes in our soul, he will never more vacate. For in us is his home of homes, and it is the greatest delight for him to dwell there. You would know our Lord's meaning in this thing? Know it well. Love was his meaning. Who showed it to you? Love. What did he show you? Love. Why did he show it? For love. Julian of Norwich. I would not want any other prayer than that which makes the virtues grow in me. It should be accompanied by great temptations, dryness and trials, leaving me with greater humility. I would consider it a good prayer. That prayer is the best prayer, pleases God the most. We always find that those who walked closest to Christ were those who had to bear the greatest trials. Teresa of Avila.
It's not just men. We tend to associate it with men, but part of revivalism that was happening was sort of a new avenue of revivalist ladies who were called anchoresses.
Mm-hmm.
And Julian of Norwich and others are these women who ended up having this space. It was like an outcropping of a building connected to the cathedral. So it's not in the cathedral. They're not officially in an office, but they're in a cell, a monastic cell, that is literally connected to the cathedral physically, and that's where they would pursue devotional life with God. But the fascinating part about that is that they had a window that was out to the village, and that the villagers could come by and ask for advice and ask for prayer. And these anchoresses who are living a monastic life had this public space where they could tell the good news to these villagers who would come up. They were really, in some ways, sort of like spiritual counselors. And so I love how the medieval church created kind of unique spaces, not technically official spaces, but unique spaces for people. And in this case, women, who, by the way, kind of interestingly enough, tended to be about age 40 or so when they would enter into this vocation, because it was seen as a time where women were moving sort of out of their younger years and into a less tempting stage, if I may put it that way.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. In the minds of the medieval mindset, that's when they would enter into this sort of life. You see this monastic movement, we tend to probably think about it in very one-dimensional ways, but it actually was quite complex and could flow into different spaces unexpectedly.
Revivalism and piety created space for women in the medieval society that otherwise wouldn't have been there. Because we're really talking about a culture that is more Aristotelian, sort of hierarchical, men are on top, women are just really deformed men. But it seemed to be that women in this space, when they devoted their life to piety, when they took vows of chastity, they were elevated. They were elevated a little above the normal woman. And then, as you said, once they sort of surpassed the temptation space in their life, they were then given this rather authoritative space, yet it was unofficial. You actually have a story you found in church history where a couple actually took a vow of celibacy.
Yeah. I mean, this is Marjorie of Kemp, who is English. Most people sort of designate her book as the first autobiography in English ever. After having 14 children, she went to her husband and basically proposed that they should have a celibate marriage from now on. So there's a lot of humor in that.
Yes.
And
I think she wanted a break.
Thank you. And he said, yes. Part of it was the piety of that time period, which saw sexuality, even in the proper confines of marriage, as still kind of tainted. So if you're going to be really pursuing God, you needed to be celibate all the way.
I blame Augustine for that.
Yes, yes. But what's fascinating is that with Marjorie, she ends up having this itinerant life all throughout Europe, even to Israel, and has this sort of charismatic gift that's given to her. Sounds strange to our ears, perhaps. But she had what they called a gift of tears. And she would say to people, if I can weep for you, I can pray for you. And it was quite moving in that context as a charismatic gift. And so she became really an itinerant evangelist of this time period, kind of the Amy Semple McPherson of her day. I love the way God takes sort of the structures that we've built of the church, and he just finds ways to kind of break out of them and do surprising things.
I think this is a good opportunity to talk about the challenges of revival. And I think for evangelicals, revival is so much part of our DNA, we could be like, well, how could it ever be a problem? Like, who would be opposed to a revival? We're trying to get one started at our church every week.
It's on the marquee. This Sunday, 5 p.m.
That's right.
Be there.
Exactly. And so what happens, though, often is I think what you're saying is that sometimes these revivals, they change the society, they change the culture, and they start to challenge those hard and fast rules that maybe people have had. And we've seen this. I mean, if you look at, say, the Waldensians and Wycliffe and Huss and Luther, some of these men lost their lives for a revival. I actually wrote an article on a woman who followed George Whitefield around Philadelphia area. Her name was Hannah Harcum Hodge. She eventually married into the Hodge family. She married one of the brothers of Charles Hodge, the famed professor from Princeton, and became a founding member at Second Presbyterian Church with Gilbert Tennant. She has sort of evangelical street cred. Yet, when she was following him around, she was thrown out of her home because her parents thought that this was extreme. It was enthusiasm. So she and her sister, in their 20s, are thrown out of the home. And her parents are not apostate. They are members of First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, which Benjamin Franklin enjoys to harass in his autobiography as well. You always see this. These revivals can create tensions on the society and the culture. And I think that makes sense, because if God's doing a work of the Spirit, he's going to unsettle and he's going to disrupt the lives of people who want to keep it a certain way.
And don't you think really where they disrupt primarily is the church itself? And that's what you see with Jesus, with the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders, and you see this all throughout church history. When revival breaks out, there's a challenge to those who are in churchly offices, who have churchly power.
Yes.
And we see that here in the medieval time period with Jan Hus, when he is looking at the corruption of the church. And don't forget, this time period, when he's around, there are three popes. If the pope is the head of your church, which one is it?
Yeah.
So he becomes a reformer, but his reforming of the church's calls for reform of the church lead into other areas as well.
Yeah.
In the Bethlehem Chapel, which we've been to in Prague, he starts to preach from the Word of God and in the language of the people. He's reading the scripture, and the sermons themselves are not in Latin. And so you start to see these breaking of sort of church cultural boundaries.
Yeah.
That get him in trouble, and he ends up being called to the Council of Constance in 1414,
right.
And he loses his life there. We see that with him. We see it with Wycliffe. He doesn't lose his life because he's got a protector, but he is castigated. And of course, we see it with Luther. It's a constant. The challenges are, when you have a real revival, you're going to challenge the church as it exists at that moment in time. Because there's always something amiss that needs correction there.
You and I have traveled to a number of countries together. I would have to admit that probably one of the weirdest pictures you've ever asked me to take of you was you standing on John Wesley's father's grave. Preaching. I just wanted a picture in Whitfield's pulpit, but you wanted a picture on Wesley's dad's grave.
And I'm a little more radical than you.
It's not just because you're into the macabre. I think it fits this story. You want to explain why you wanted that picture?
Well, I mean, he's outside the church. I mean, he's outside the four walls. He's been kicked out.
Right. John Wesley can't even preach in his own father's church. He's been kicked out of that church.
Right. He's got to be on his grave, which is, if you go there, it's literally right outside the church.
Right.
But he's outside the church.
And
he's
technically, that real estate, that 6 foot by whatever, is owned by the Wesley family. Therefore, they can't arrest him.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Exactly. So we see this over and over again. People being moved out of the church.
Yeah.
The irony in all that is that as soon as you move these people outside the church, they actually, this the popular part of the definition of revivalism, it actually is a boost to it.
Yep.
Because they then go to the people, and they may have been tempted to stay in the church.
Yes.
But they've been kicked out, sort of like when the disciples are persecuted in Jerusalem and they get kicked out, right? Jesus had said, go to the ends of the earth. You get to chapter 9 in the book of Acts, all the disciples are still in Jerusalem. Apparently, they don't understand what Jesus means when he says, go to the ends of the earth.
Right.
And so what does it take to get them out? They get persecuted by the religious leaders, and that moves them. And I think that's another one of these counterintuitive parts of revivalism, that as you challenge, you get pushback from the authorities who try to get rid of you by pushing you out. And by pushing you out, oftentimes, that's where you find the audience that's receptive to the gospel of Jesus Christ.
So last year, I had the opportunity to take about 50 undergrad students from Lancaster Bible College down to Philadelphia in the Old City area. And we did a bit of a African-American/early American church history tour. And I took them to where Whitfield would preach right there at 2nd and Market. And one of the students had picked up, they noticed, they said, I don't understand something. Why is Whitfield preaching in the middle of the street on the courthouse steps when there's churches on every corner? Weren't they there then?
Right.
And I said, no, those churches were there. They were there. They said, well, I don't understand. Like, because then later we took them to Christ Church, which is the famous. They said, well, why wouldn't he just go preach in there? Because that's there. I said, he wasn't allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh. And that whole area, because it was the market, and then all the churches were around, and then the courthouse was in the middle. And so there, Whitfield has to go to the secular space because the ecclesiastical space has boxed him out. And his chief sort of evangelist is none other than the deist Benjamin Franklin. But it was very interesting that 20-year-olds just asked that question. Why is he preaching in the middle of the street?
And the irony again is the church may have held 200, 300, 400, 500 people, and they end up preaching, you know, to 10, 15, sometimes 20,000 people at a time. Could not have happened in the church, right?
No.
Billy Graham could do it because we had stadiums. But pre-stadium, it was the open field where you would be at. I think we should cover one last thing here, and this is really kind of near and dear to your heart, Mark. It's one of those things that we often see in revivalistic times, and that's sort of the growth of an apocalyptic or millennial perspective. One can kind of understand this, right? You're in the midst of experiencing God in a brand new way. And not just you, but as we've talked about, there's been this expansion into a movement of many, many people. You start thinking, is there something even larger at work here? Is this the thing that the Bible is pointing to?
It's a common trope that you will see in revival movements, where people start to think, oh, I guess we're at the end of time. So you will see some of these apocalyptic movements emerge. And sometimes they're healthy. Other times they're not healthy, because you sort of get rogue prophets and, you know, rogue interpretations and things like that, like you'll see in Munster during the Reformation. But then you'll have others, someone like Joachim of Fiore, who really believes sort of divides up time into a trinity, an age of God, age of the Jesus, and age of the Spirit, believes we are in the age of the Spirit. And when we are in the age of the Spirit, which is the end, everybody will be living as monastics.
Which these are the most devout people.
Exactly. Here in America, the Second Great Awakening, everyone was high on millennialism. It was everywhere. Everybody thought something was happening. So you're right. There's always this tendency for the Christian, when they see the Spirit of God being poured out, they're waiting for the next shoe to drop. I think even in your studies too, Joe, with Pentecostalism, you see it there, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you go to Azusa Street, and it's all about the expectation of the soon return of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
How can the bride of Christ be ready for the return of Christ?
Yes.
And so that drives a lot of the preaching, a lot of the teaching. That's one of the characteristics that we see all throughout church history and into the New Testament, is this quality of holiness seems to be aspirational. It's recognized that God is holy, we should be holy, and revivalism always is touching on that point, because obviously we are unholy people. You know, we're redeemed. Those of us who are redeemed, but there's always more that can be redeemed
yeah.
within our lives. And so amongst the larger populace, there's always a sense that no one is quite reaching the holiness of God. And that's part of the call, I think.
It actually makes a lot of sense. If people are becoming more devotional, they've sort of aligned their life properly, and now God is back into the center, you become even more aware that where you live currently is not right, and you want to go home. And so maybe that's part of it, yeah. right? Where we should almost expect it. It encourages the longing for, I want to be the new heavens and new earth.
Yes.
That's where I belong.
The heavenly city.
And I feel at a joint. And I think when we're not walking with God, it's very easy for this to feel like home.
Mm.
So you don't have the same longing.
What are some wayfinding kind of ideas or principles, or sometimes we call them wayfinding cues,
yeah.
that we can take from looking at revivalism over the first 1,000 years or so within the church?
Yeah. Generally, there was some sort of corruption in the church, sometimes from wealth, from power. I mean, many of the monasteries became corrupted because of the amount of wealth they were able to produce for praying people out of purgatory. By the time of the Reformation, some people estimate that the Catholic Church owned about 1/3 of the real estate in Europe. It's corrupting. And so I think that's one of the things we always have to be aware of, is that sometimes you can be a victim of your own success.
Mm.
And you take your eye off the new heavens and new earth, and you start to think your new cathedral is that spot.
Yeah, I think I remember Jesus saying something like, you can't serve God and money both.
Yes.
That is corrupting. Power is corrupting. One of the things we absolutely see in the Middle Ages under Pope Boniface is this call for the papacy to be recognized as the king of the entire universe.
Mm.
And the astounding grasp of that statement is just amazing. And it really speaks to, again, this sense that you can never be too alert to the corrupting influence of money, to the corrupting influence of power, and to have a sensitivity to ask God to be continuing to give you a spiritual sensitivity if either of those are creeping into your life. And in our case, more importantly here, into the institutions of our life, into the church,
yeah.
into the school, into the seminary, into the theologian,
yeah.
who, you know, whatever, popularity, fame, all kinds of possibilities for corruption.
If we look at John Calvin's line that the heart is a factory for idols.
Yeah.
So that means we're always constantly dealing, as we are reviving, our heart could also be creating something else. It's a full-time job to be vigilant on this. And also part of that, I think, is control. We want to control the circumstances, we want to control our situation. And part of true devotion and piety has to be less control, more reliance on God.
As we've looked over this span of church history, what are some wayfinding cues that are positive in the sense of, you know, these are things that we should be cultivating?
I come back to this issue and think the star of the stories of all these articles put together has to be God. Because God has been faithful. This is what this story is showing. He's drawing people back to himself. We love those passages in scripture where say God is calling a people and making a people and all of this, but we probably don't always like all the work that goes into what that looks like. But what God is doing in this entire issue, you are seeing God is calling people back to himself because that's what he wants. He wants us back. How do I learn from this issue? Not that you need to go join a monastery. I don't think that, you know, we're going to have an advertisement at the end of this for that. But there's something about that devotional piece that is so important. Even if it's not popular, at least personally, we have to be devotionally committed to God in whatever ways that looks like. Because personally, that is what's going to bring transformation. Personally, that is what's going to keep us from going off the rails.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mark Draper, for joining us. This is Dr. Joe Thomas, the Wayfinding Podcast, and we want to invite you back. We will also be looking at two other issues that Christian History Magazine has done on revivalism. One, a little bit more sort of in our wheelhouse, which is 17, 18, 19 centuries.
Yes.
And then a third one, which will be on 20th century, 21st century, and thinking about that. So we want to invite all the listeners to continue on with us as we talk about revivalism in the history of the church.